You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the meeting grounds for spirituality and society, religion and culture.
Pauline Rooney, bringing you Expanding Horizons. The focus for today's program is poverty. Our guest presenter is Rob McPherson, who is the lay preacher at the lovely Shady Grove Unitarian Church, which is tucked away in the Adelaide Hills. The Bible wasn't really strong on fiscal advice. There was the camel and the eye of the needle and the rich man in the kingdom of heaven, and then came the admonition, lay not up treasures on earth. Take no thought for the morrow. Hardly a clue on strong economic planning. What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, right. That whole anti-materialist angle is certainly one of Jesus' toughest messages, right up there with turning the other cheek. A message evangelicals, I note, seem to have missed in their careful study of the Bible. This hard lesson has been given added weight by the events of the last few months. In case you've missed it, there's been an abrupt disintegration of the uncritical, consensual, blind faith in unregulated free markets. Imaginary money was created, then gambled upon, and more money was thus made on the imaginary money. Then reality caught up as it does, and $15 trillion worldwide that everybody thought was real simply vanished. Poof. Governments across the world are gripped by fiscal panic, and you know it's serious when governments and opposition start holding hands and working together. In the private sphere, individuals, too, have begun to go quietly insane all over the world. There are reports of bullion supplies running out because people want gold rather than currency. People are selling off decent stocks, pulling money out of banks and stuffing it into mattresses. Sales of canned goods, bottled water, batteries, and survivalist manuals are going through the roof. Panic, panic. The woods are burning. Well, they'd be forgiven for going a bit loopy, I think, for thinking there may be something to end times prophecy, and visions of a Mad Max post-global meltdown future dance in their heads, haunted by the fear that, since no one knows how to actually do anything anymore, that when the food and the energy run out, and they'll be reduced to eating their pets before starving slowly, miserably to death, only to be eaten by the feral pets owners thought too cute to eat. I'm told they'll start with the eyes. Funny, isn't it, how things seem to change so utterly, so quickly? Our greatest concern as a species, it seems, no longer includes accelerating climate change, deepening world hunger, or the slaughter of innocents in imperialist wars, dwindling oil, and the shift of power toward the central command economies of China and Russia, who regard personal freedom and political liberty as dangerous. Oh no. Now it's, what's going to happen to my super, my house value, my job? And now I'll never be able to afford that flat-screen TV. When Jesus suggested that to make your peace with money and state power, we should render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's, he did not say anything about rendering unto your superfund or bank account or hip pocket. Jesus, that scamp. So irrelevant in this sophisticated day and age. The world economy of superfunds, bank accounts, and hip pockets has, up till now, been driven largely by U.S. consumerism, which accounts for 70% of all U.S. economic activity. Think about that. The world economy driven by Americans being persuaded to buy oceans of consumables. No wonder obesity there is a problem. And this was fueled by easy credit, and it's now been exposed for the house of cards it always was. Have you ever been inside a Walmart? Imagine a cheap as chips the size of Adelaide Airport and you get some idea. All of it full of cheap tat that no one could imagine 50 years ago, but has, in the blink of an historical eye, somehow become crucial to global human progress and happiness, it seems. You can buy, for example, a small fridge for $3. Yeah, I know it's junk and leaks CFCs and will last about a month and was probably assembled in dreadful sweatshop conditions by political prisoners with AK-47s at their heads, but hey, it's a fridge for $3. Multiply that equation 300 million times and you get a sense of the problems, political, economic, and moral problems, that might arise from a world economy based on cheap goods and easy credit. How did this happen? How did this get to be the world we want? The reason, of course, is that we forget that ideologies can kill. Uncritical acceptance of unproven ideas are for us like water for fish, hidden in plain sight, taken for granted, and just as often wrong. Of course money can buy happiness. Of course free markets are good markets. Of course enlightened self-interest benefits everyone. Of course liberal free market capitalism is the best and final system. Of course trickle-down economic theory makes sense. After all, if the rich have bigger and richer meals, the scraps that fall from the table will be more plentiful and will benefit. You betcha. What are you, a socialist? All these have up till lately been meekly accepted as normal, natural, right, and inevitable. I think it's no bad thing that these myths have been busted by a small clutch of 29-year-old stockbrokers driving their Maseratis off into the Hampton sunset while smoking Cuban cigars and yelling, "So long, suckers!" Easy money and endless goods are a species of addiction, a drug to take away the pain of living in an otherwise intolerable world. It's no good blaming the producers of easy credit and cheap goods. They're just filling a need. The real question is, how did people in so-called developed countries come to need so much stuff, as well as so much easy credit and imaginary money to buy them? Blaise Pascal said that most of our trouble comes from not being able to sit quietly in our own rooms. He's right. Rampant, gluttonous consumerism masks a deep spiritual emptiness. Why do I need to fill the hole in my soul with every bauble and doodad and gewgaw under the sun? Do they make me feel less lonely? Am I so terrified of boredom that I need a constant stream of things to detain my attention? Were I imprisoned, would I have nothing within myself to make life worth living? Would I simply go mad without the endless parade of the latest stuff? How did the world get to be this way, driven by an insatiable hunger for diversion and junk? Is there anything we can do to free ourselves from participating in this madness? Our lives are full of contradictions about this issue. For example, it's interesting to note that all our spiritual heroes, those that history has traditionally revered, were all stony broke by choice. If Jesus were alive today, he and his posse would be living under a bridge, eating on handouts like freegans. He had given up a perfectly good and respectable skilled trade of carpentry. And you know how much these guys make. Barefoot Socrates, too, was a skilled craftsman, a stonemason before he gave it up to live on the Athenian dole of fish and olives and bread, and hang around the marketplace engaging people in conversation, filling the head of the young with revolutionary ideas. I used to think that if I had life to do over again, I'd have learned a trade. That way you can always earn a crust. The work of the craftsman, knowing how to make, grow, and repair stuff, is unequivocal. That is, it does not depend on the good opinion of others. If you can put a nut to a bolt, plane a door, build a table, or shape stone to fit a niche, you'll always be needed. Yet these two trained craftsmen just gave up what we'd recognize as responsibility and a secure income, and decided to be poor. Going up the social scale in history, Gandhi was a lawyer, for heaven's sake, and a good one. When did you last see a lawyer starve? Yet he rejected the comfortable middle-class professional life for spiritual and political activism that freed a nation. And Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, was a prince. He was royalty. And yet he left his father's house and starved himself nearly to death while seeking enlightenment. Those we revere as brave did not fear the sort of poverty that would have driven us to despair. Why not? Were they on to something? Did they know something we don't? Is that why we guiltily revere them, but don't do likewise? Or are they just no longer relevant, and our reverence for their turning their back on materialism is just a quaint hangover from the old days, now useful only to point a moral we no longer follow. I, too, have some experience of poverty to draw on as I thought about these questions. My parents, both of them, lived through the Great Depression of the 1920s and 30s. In my comfortable, post-war baby boom upbringing, they never failed to regale me with stories about how tough it was, in contrast to the cushy life they were determined to provide me with. Of course, kids are uniquely able to spot such contradictory lessons. Being poor is character building and ennobling, but we don't want you to be poor, son, and we're damned if we're not going to give you everything under the sun. Huh? Obviously, there are contradictions in our culture about wealth and about poverty, and there's nothing like a panic to make us lose all perspective about how we feel about money and goods and our collective futures. But loss of perspective is the opportunity to gain a better one, to refocus on what really matters. You know the one about crisis and opportunity being two sides of the same coin. The panic that has gripped the world is, at its core, a purely neurotic state, not unlike the distinction Freud made between neurotic misery and ordinary human unhappiness. His technique of psychoanalysis could only address the first, that is, neurotic misery, and could do, he said, nothing about ordinary human unhappiness, which was just part of living. Lately, I've been thinking that our collective anxieties over peak energy, climate change, and the global financial collapse might just be leading us to re-experience what I might call, after Freud, ordinary human poverty. Not endless gluttony, and not certainly the extremes of poverty that are experienced right now in Haiti, for example, where people are actually eating dirt to ward off hunger. The state of ordinary human poverty is, looked at in a historical perspective, quite the normal state of affairs for humans, despite the pathological despair and horror most of us experience when we think of the word poverty. We've been there before, especially in a hardscrabble country like this. When did we last experience it as a culture? Well, I'd cast my mind back again to my parents' generation. As I said earlier, they grew up in the Depression. Things they used to say about their remembered lives have come to mean more to me now. They'd say things like, "We were poor, but there was always food on the table." Or, "Our clothes were patched, but we could always afford soap." Or, "We were poor, but we really didn't know it." Or, "We were poor, but we had just enough." Or, "We were poor, but we were happy." My mother had it harder. She was the out-of-wedlock daughter of a cleaning lady who lived in boarding houses. She counted herself lucky. You only have to read The Grapes of Wrath to realize that not everybody growing up in the 1930s had it so easy. There's a moving chapter in it about dispossessed Okies watching Californian farmers burn a trench full of oranges just to keep the price up, while the Okies' children died of scurvy. The children crying with their teeth falling out, the parents blind with impotent rage as the oranges burned, as the large farming combines blithely burned that which would have kept them alive. There's the free market for you. Some free market. Some blind faith in what is thought to be normal, but is actually pathological. Still, by any of today's standards, Mom was dirt poor, a level of poverty that would shame us, but she claims that she was happy. We were poor, but happy. And this last saying really stuck with me, no matter how much post-war Coke and ice cream I had to wash it down with. How can you be poor and happy? Well, there was a time I got to find out how. It may interest you to know that I've not always been the prosperous bourgeois professional you have before you now. When I moved to the UK with my young wife at the age of 28, we had a kid almost immediately, thanks to the NHS, and we were poor. But I think I'm not rewriting history by saying that we were indeed happy, living on my meager teaching wage of $10,000 a year, living in tiny rented accommodation where mushrooms grew in the damp closets. Poverty in the UK, I call it now. But strangely, my God, were we happy. And it wasn't just because we were young and hopeful and in love and seeing the wider world for the first time. I mean, I remember discovering gardening for the first time. There are photos of me gleefully weeding the Victorian garden of our cottage with its riot of primroses, hyacinths, and daffodils. And while I did, I thought of the old tradesman who probably planted them 100 years before, found scraps of his tobacco tins and bottles while I was digging. And I swear to you, I sang while I did this. And I did it a lot. It was easier to be happy then, it seems to me now. when the cottage seemed too cramped, we took walks in Windsor Great Park nearby, taking the air. Bill Bryson said that only in the UK could mere respiration be a form of pastime. Then there were cups of tea after the walk or a visit to a cool, dark pub. We wore thrift shop clothes like a badge of pride. We had no super funds, no savings of money, no locks on the doors as we had nothing to steal, and it wasn't even our house anyway. We had enough, just enough. And I slept in those days like a baby. Ordinary human poverty for the majority of history and for the majority of the people who have ever lived on this planet has been the norm and not, I say, to be feared. There are steps we can take to avoid buying into the panic that attends our idea of poverty. We can reduce what we take to be our needs and to confront and challenge a culture that tells us that poor is dirty and bad. That sharing your food, sharing your homes, even, is a virtue, not a shame. We can take steps to free ourselves from the pull of money panic by aiming for self-sufficiency, which is the true opposite of poverty, not wealth. The garden, the sewing needle, the hammer and the saw. And I'll bet there are a few of listeners out there who are savers of string. There are steps we can take. We could love and trust each other more, work together more. Look, for example, at the shared meal that the Shady Grove community enjoys after every one of its services. Not fancy, not expensive, but good and nourishing and filling. The food on our table and the people we share it with are the point, not whether Maggie Beer or Gordon Ramsay had anything to do with the preparation. As in the old story of Stone Soup, it's the trick of community that makes it possible for everyone to eat. It's interesting to note that where there is rampant wealth, there is no community. There are gated communities, which is a contradiction in terms, locks on doors, security systems, protecting the individual wealth that is being hoarded. And this is one source of the panic, it seems to me. We have no faith that there are any other mechanisms that will take care of us when times are tough, that even our children will not look after us when we can no longer look after ourselves. Reducing needs, achieving self-sufficiency, and recognizing the wealth of a community, these things are ordinary and human too, and always with us. And with them, we can never be truly poor. But I've left out, I fear, a crucial element to help us fend off the grinding anxiety of these troubled economic times. That I almost forgot to mention it is telling, as it's often forgotten. It's called gratitude. Gratitude. Giving thanks for the myriad blessings that we've known in our lives and for the beauty and wonder all around us. Because when you think about it, life is abundantly, insanely gratuitous. Ask yourselves, my friends, what have we actually done to deserve to be here now? To have had the experiences we have had? The beauty we have seen and known? The music that has enriched our lives, inspired us, moved us to tears, made us happy? It never fails to strike me as wonderful that I can sit in my lounge room and put a disc the size of a beer mat into a machine and hear Herbert von Karajan and the Berlin Symphony Orchestra play Beethoven's Ninth in my living room. What have I done to deserve such sublime beauty, more or less free, a gratuity for just being alive? The beautiful lovers we have had, what have we done to deserve them? Or the friends we've been able to rely on simply because they cared for us? What have we done to deserve them? The books we have read and the films we have seen, the work of countless brilliant, talented minds that have expanded our consciousness and enlightened us. What have we done to earn these? The wonderful meals that have been cooked for us by hands unknown, the wine that we've tasted, fruit of soil enriched by centuries, and the work of hands skilled in traditions going back to the dawn of history. Think of your children. The luminous beings produced as naturally as flowers and grass. What have I done to deserve such beauty, such grace, and love, and purpose in my life? So many gifts, my friends. When I am awake at night sweating over the fact that one-third of my already meager super has been just driven off with a 25-year-old Harvard Business School grad, I need to remind myself that I have watched the sunrise over the Parthenon, snorkeled the reefs of Bermuda, walked in the footsteps of Canterbury pilgrims on the South Downs, heard early Mass in Notre Dame Cathedral, acted Hamlet for an audience of thousands, loved and been loved by beautiful, generous women, skied on a Swiss glacier while sucking a blood orange, and stood on the spot where St. Paul was tried in Corinth. How can I say that I am? How can I ever be, ever, poor, when so many blessings have rained gratuitously, utterly undeserved, like manna from heaven down on my one human life? And think, too, of the present, of the beauty of where we are, forged by the same forces that made and that move the sun and the other stars. What have we done to deserve the beauty, the goodness, the wonder of a life in this world? St. Augustine said, "People go abroad to wonder at the height of mountains, at the huge waves of the sea, at the long course of rivers, at the vast compass of the ocean and the circular motion of the stars, and they pass by themselves without wondering." Now let us acknowledge the wonder of our physical incarnation, that we are here, in these particular bodies, at this particular time, in these particular circumstances. May we never take for granted the gift of our individuality. And Eric Hoffer said, "The hardest arithmetic to master is that which enables us to count our blessings." So why do we not say thanks more often? Whom in your life do you appreciate? Let them know. Give thanks to them in word and in deed. Feeling gratitude and not expressing it is like wrapping up a wonderful present and then not giving it. What in your life do you appreciate? Music, the night skies, the swaying trees, birdsong, a warm home, delicious food. Again, say it, even if it's only to yourself, or to the God of your understanding, or to just the universe. Buddha said that when eating bean sprouts, never forget to remember the man that grew them. Let me tell you, my friends, developing an attitude of gratitude is a powerful habit. It can ward off jealousy, negativity, develops a positive frame of reference within which positive things happen. And studies show it is even good for your health. Every day, every moment, if we but train ourselves to see, there are opportunities for gratitude, for giving thanks. Gratitude in relation to others is simple good manners, but in relation to ourselves, it is a habit of the heart that can change how we see the world. All that is required is paying attention, noticing the beauty, love, and gifts we experience in life. Back in my long-lost homeland of the United States, November is the month I most look forward to because in it we celebrate my favorite and perhaps most uniquely American holiday, Thanksgiving. It's a day dedicated not to gifts and to shopping, but simply a day where the custom is to get together with family, friends, and community and recognize and celebrate the gratuitousness, the insane bounty of our lives and give public, out loud thanks for it. Every nation on earth should have this day. Indeed, Thanksgiving Day should be every day. We should give thanks for it all, for each other, and for our utterly improbable lives on this planet, here and now. And so I wish for you all a grateful heart and many occasions for praise and blessing so that Thanksgiving can live within you all the days of your life.
You have been listening to Expanding Horizons. Today, Rob McPherson has shared his ideas on his view on riches we can all share, a different take on the seriousness of this global financial crisis, termed the GFC by many companies, now taking the opportunity to take some long overdue steps in reviewing business structure and organisation. Expanding Horizons is produced in the studios of Radio Adelaide by members and friends of the Unitarian Church of South Australia. For more information, visit our website, adelaideunitarians.org.au, or join us at our meeting house, 99 Osmond Terrace, Norwood, any Sunday morning at 10:30. Without ongoing support from listeners and volunteers, Radio Adelaide would be unsustainable. There is always a great diversity of voices needing to be heard in any community. You can help them go to air by becoming a subscriber to Radio Adelaide. It will cost you only a dollar a week, half that if you're on concession. Phone 8303 5000 for information about subscribing.
that's our episode of Expanding Horizons for the week. The introduction is a piece named Elements by the artist CDK. The piece is licensed under Creative Commons and can be found from a link on our media website. And be sure to visit our media website, unitariansa.wordpress.com. This is White Rabbit, out.